My guest today, Deanna Johnstone, is a Paris-based American journalist who has spent the better part of her life living in France and Europe and writing on subjects that deal with Europe. She gained her BA in Russian Area Studies and PhD in French Literature from the University of Minnesota. And she was also active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, organizing the first international contacts between American citizens and Vietnamese representatives. She was a European editor of the U.S. Weekly In These Times from 1979 to 1990, after which she was press officer for the Green Group in the European Parliament from 1990 to 1996. For some years, she has been a frequent contributor to Counterpunch, both online and in the print editions. And in the current edition of the latter, she has an article on the political reaction to the Charlie Hebdo shootings, about which we are going to lead off today's discussion. She has been my guest twice before, one of which I conducted in her Paris apartment, after which we went down the street for a delightful dinner. Unfortunately, we can't do that today. In 2003, she published Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, which described the dismemberment of that country by U.S.-led NATO forces. Welcome, once again, Deanna Johnstone, to Takes on the World.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be talking to you again, Jeffrey.
It really is, and I'm sorry we can't have dinner tonight.
Yes, so am I.
Well, in the current issue of Counterpunch, the written edition, which I admit I have not read, but I have been following your other comments and articles, as I mentioned, you have written about the political responses of the magazine of Charlie Hebdo. And let's start with you telling us about that, which seems to be very critical in terms of French politics.
Well, Charlie Hebdo, there were two Charlie Hebdos. That is to say, there was one that was back in the 68 generations, Charlie Hebdo. And it's always been a very disrespectful weekly. But the thing is that it started off as making fun of everybody in power. I mean, it was a very much sort of an anarchist thing, and it would make fun of the government. It made fun of Christianity in a way that I would not do, because I don't care for that style, which is sort of insults things by obscenity, which I don't think is a very good argument. But that's the way it was, but it was against the powers that be. It went out of business because the powers that be sort of stopped being powers, actually, and things changed a lot. I mean to say, for instance, the Catholic Church lost influence, Gaullism and lost influence, and so it went out of business, and then it came back, and the version that came back is the one that's been under attack, and instead of attacking the powers that be, it concentrated on the powers that that the West, especially the United States, Israel, etc., are attacking, and that means Islam, and also whichever dictator the humanitarian warfare people want to get rid of becomes the big villain. So actually, Charlie Hebdo turned its venom, cartooning against the targets of the West, so that it, instead of being an anti-power journal, it became one that was actually supporting the powers that be. What caused the disaster was that it was publishing very nasty, I mean, really obscene cartoons against, the prophet, supposedly. Of course, it bore no resemblance whatever to anything. These were constant insults to Islam. So it wasn't just one or two occasionally. It was really a regular... was their signature, practically.
Well, I noticed last time I was there, which is, I believe, 2007, I picked up a copy of it, and this is before the controversy over the cartoons of Muhammad, but in general, I found it essentially taking the side of the right wing of French politics, even though purportedly the people at Charlie Hebdo came from the left. In France, it doesn't always work that way. And
but that's a commentary on what the left has become to a large extent. The left has become the right, as Jean Bricmont puts it. The left has really, to a large extent, that part of the left has taken the positions that used to be the positions of the right, that is to be in favor of wars, which is really, and to have sort of contempt for ordinary people. And really, that is something that has corrupted the whole left. The idea that the great thing is to be against a dictator. Well, a dictator, whoever the West is attacking right about now. We don't notice dictators except when there's a big Western campaign to regime change. And all of a sudden we get alarmed about the dictator, even if the dictator isn't a dictator. Even if it's an elected president, it becomes a dictator. And Charlie Hebdo would have cartoons showing how awful he was.
Well, one thing that I was curious in all the discussions in the French press, but of course it wasn't here. Was there any discussion about France's history? The two people who carried out the massacre were Algerian in their background, and France had a long and really ugly history in Algeria, as well as all much of North Africa, as well as the Middle East. And today, of course, in recent years, they have been an ally of the United States in the war against Islam, which has been perceived in the Middle East as a war against Islam, despite the fact the majority of people killed being killed by Islamic State, so ISIS, Daesh, are Muslims. Was there any discussion of the role that Charlie Hebdo was playing in this, and the role that France was playing, contributing to what became this massacre?
Well, yeah, of course, but I don't think it goes back so far as to Algeria. After all, I don't think that Algeria has won its independence quite some time ago. And that was a war which ended with the notion of the peace of the brave. There were atrocities on all sides, and it sort of France lost. And I don't think a resentment of that has anything to do with what's going on now. The terrorists, when they were interviewed, said that actually, at least the one who got to speak, said that his turn to terrorism was watching Abu Ghraib. It was watching the Americans in Iraq. It isn't the French, it's the Americans. And of course, France goes along with that. But it's not something that goes back to Algeria. It's right now.
Well, it's true, and we also have this hypocrisy on the part of Washington in which they do not want to release photographic evidence that shows that what happened in Abu Ghraib was not an aberration, and that far worse has taken place. We Americans may be unaware of it, but people throughout the Middle East are certainly not unaware of it. I know this is kind of now seems to have led to a double standard in terms of quote-unquote free expression in France, where the only free expression that's allowed seemed to be is that supporting the positions of Charlie Hebdo and of the French government, and those who even utter words that might be used as criticizing or supporting even sarcastically or satirically the assassins get arrested and fined and put in prison.
Well, yeah, but it's a little bit, it's very strange indeed, because the first thing that the government has done after celebrating freedom of expression is to crack down on it. This is so obviously absurd, it's hard to go on and on about it. It's just perfectly clear. I mean, one of the first things they did was to arrest the comedian Giordano for some remark that he'd made, which was considered politically incorrect. I mean, they didn't keep him in jail. He'll just be going to court again for the umpteenth time because he's always being sued for something that he said that they don't like. But and he wins. He wins these suits very often, by the way. But what I think is very significant is that this event, after the big demonstration in Paris and so on, then they started going in the schools, and they had every children have to a minute of silence in respect for the Charlie Hebdo victims and so on, and then they're talking to them, and the teachers all over France, every single one of them is more or less told to discuss this with the students, and the students are supposed to say the right thing. And the very interesting fact is that a lot of the students didn't say the right thing, and they didn't want to do a minute of silence. Of course, I think obliging children to do a minute of silence is ridiculous anyway. I mean, I remember being, well, I don't know, a child or a teenager, but every time there was a minute of silence, I just felt like laughing, you know. I mean, I just don't like to be told, you know, that I have to have a particular attitude, even for a minute. But this showed up a real split in the population. And I was mentioning that the old Charlie Hebdo was a favorite of the 68 generation. So people, that's the generation that's in power now. And they look back on Charlie Hebdo with sort of nostalgia, even if nobody read it anymore, because it was about to go bankrupt. Now it's the richest paper in France because of this publicity and government support and so on. But but the younger generation, a lot of them, and it isn't a matter of being Muslims, they just don't like it. And a lot of them are sensitive to the fact that Charlie Hebdo could get away with insulting like crazy, really in a vile way, whereas Dieudonné, favorite comedian of the younger generation, is in trouble all the time, being accused of anti-Semitism and one thing and another. And this has revealed this split, and the people in power seem absolutely appalled. They didn't seem to realize that the young weren't thinking the way they're supposed to. So there's a huge campaign now to make the young think correctly, and it's becoming quite grotesque. I mean, it's really it's not just that they're arresting people, but that they're going to real campaigns in class to make people have the right attitude about all these things. Now, I just doubt that that's going to work. But this goes along with an attack on the Internet, because one reason that the young don't think the way they're supposed to is that they're looking at the Internet. And of course, then this is going to bring attacks against the Internet.
Well, one thing that I've noticed when I was in France was, and in reading articles after this occurred, is that the large Muslim community, which is much of which was impoverished and lives out in the banlieue outside of Paris, they're not considered, even if they're born in France or their parents are born in France, to be authentic French. And I remember I have photographs taken back in 1970 of the French police harassing Algerians with the same manner in which white policemen harass young black and Latino men in the barrios and ghettos of the United States for no reason at all. And it seems this would also contribute to the atmosphere of being the other and left out, and then demands being made by the French government to be a true French person?
Well, I would calm that down a little bit. For one thing, I think that situation is much better than it was in the 70s. And it also depends where and where you are. And after all, I mean, everybody knows now about how the police behave toward people in the United States, and here it's absolutely not comparable. I think you'd make a mistake to have your listeners in California imagine that Arabs in France are treated the way blacks are, shot, you know, dead for nothing. That when that happens here, it's a huge scandal and so on and so on, whereas in the United States, it's sort of ordinary. That happens all the time. It's sort of normal. There's been a big fuss about it recently, but it's perfectly standard operating, and it's considered that way, and nobody gets in trouble about it. I don't think it's really comparable to that. And a lot quite a lot of Muslims are doing pretty well. It's not there. I don't think it's that all that they're all that poor. I really think it's more what's going on in the world. I think it's what's going on in the Middle East, and it's the fact that Israel is defended all the time and more, and they see this double standards. I think it's the double standards more than the economy, because actually a lot of people are in trouble in the economy right now. It's not just, you know, one group. The economic situation is pretty bad all around, but there's this sense of double standard, and with the fact that people, where did I just see the figure that something like 20,000 foreigners now are fighting for the Islamic State or Daesh or whatever you call it in Syria? This is drawing Muslims from all over the world, And I compared this in an article, and I'll repeat this comparison, that the Islamic State, whatever you want to call it, in Syria, in Iraq, is sort of an equivalent of Israel for Muslims. It's a new state being created on the territory of old states, a religious state just like Israel, and it's drawing people all over as a great cause to go and fight and die for. It's sort of the Israel of the Muslims.
That's a very interesting perspective, because people will say, oh, how can they say that? But of course, you had a situation with 750,000 people were ethnically cleansed, 500 villages destroyed, and there was massacres took place, some of which have not been recognized except by the survivors, and the world looked on and did nothing. This is just 3 years after the concentration camps of Hitler had been liberated. So it does seem strange that people would want to go and fight for this particular cause, and isn't necessarily beheadings or horrible setting on fire, but the creation of Israel has not been thoroughly examined except by some certain Israeli historians. In terms of the ethnic cleansing, but it is interesting in the role that Israel's playing, particularly now we have Netanyahu coming to Washington, sneaking into Washington and causing a controversy because he's simply coming there to defy the world, which wants to have a settlement between Iran and the West over its nuclear enrichment program, and Israel demands, without ever acknowledging its own several hundred nuclear weapons, that the world bow to Israel's dictate.
Well, you see, the Western governments really, it looks as if, you know, there are some signs that Obama might want to make a deal with Iran, but he doesn't make it. And, I mean, this just goes on and on. But, I mean, I'm not going to compare the atrocities of the Islamic State to atrocities. I'm not talking about atrocities. I'm more talking about the attractiveness of the idea.
No, I understand.
And the fact is that the Muslims can feel that their country, you know, they've just been taking it, and the U.S. has smashed this one, and then it smashes another, and this idea of this Islamic cause, the fact that it appeals to a lot of young people, I think it's not necessarily because they're poor. I think it's ideological. That it gives them something to live for. Of course it's not my ideal, but neither is Israel my ideal. I'm not in favor of any of this going off and creating a new state on somebody else's territory. I don't think it's a very peaceful idea. But it is. This was really apparently what was going on with these terrorists that attacked Charlie Hebdo, and I don't think that many people. I don't know about what sympathy they have. I don't think so. I mean, I think that the people that don't go along with the correct thinking, it isn't that they sympathize with the murders or anything like that. I think it's just that the double standards bothers people a lot, and that goes back to Dieudonné, because he's been sort of the object of the double standard play.
Well, my guest, Diana Johnston, we've been talking about the situation in Paris in the wake of Charlie Hebdo and connected that to the appeal to young Muslims who feel themselves disenfranchised, who see double standards at work in the world, the appeal to join Daesh or the so-called Islamic State.
Plenty of countries who don't have any colonial history, but Muslims are going from that. So it isn't just a matter of France's colonial history. There are young people going from all over to join this.
Well, you know, Britain has a great number. It is something that almost seems, well, it was created largely by beginning, I guess, with U.S. intervention in Afghanistan in 1979, and the Iraq War of 2003, which actually one of the killers of the Charlie Hebdo mentioned that he was activated, as you mentioned, by the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which began to destroy the stability of the region.
Yeah. Particularly Iraq, which was really destroyed. And, of course, one of the many ironies of all this is now you have Muslims, whereas Iraq was not an Islamic state. It was, and we've destroyed all of the nationalist, more or less secular states. And what goes into the vacuum is an extreme Islamism.
Right. Whatever one thought of Hafez al-Assad or his son Bashar or Gaddafi, they were the bastions of secularism in the Middle East. The U.S. allied itself with the reactionary forces in the Islamic world, the Saudis, Qatar, and so on, the Emirates, and this is what we've got. Listen, I'd like to have to shift it to quarter to the hour. I'd like to shift gears to another troubled spot which you've been writing about lately, which is Ukraine, which you've written about the Western effort to design another iron curtain between Russia and the West. And maybe you could lead into that.
Well, what I see happening now, I think that's almost an optimistic way of looking at it, because I'm really appalled by what I read of the anti-Russian propaganda in the American media now. I'm really stunned by this. It's the torrent of lies and vituperation. I mean, this is war propaganda, which it is more violent than I think ever was even in the World War. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I'm really frightened now because the propaganda is so intense and so widespread. I don't see how the United States can avoid ending up in war with Russia, with a nuclear power. They're just going on and on about how we must stop this and this. It's incredible. And I don't know how they're talking themselves into World War III.
Well,
hello?
I'm here. Yes, I have done a number of programs on this issue, including playing the recordings of Victoria Nuland Kagan, the wife of the co-founder of the Project New American Century and Hillary Clinton's former press spokesperson. Her telephone conversation with U.S. ambassador in Ukraine about who their person was, who they wanted to come in and replace Yanukovych. And Yanukovych, we had made an arrangement with the four European leaders to have a new elections, a fact that has been totally erased from the American media, which would have provided for a free election and a new president. But there are the forces coming from the United States obviously did not want a free election. They wanted a coup.
Well, also because the coup resulted in an inevitable reaction in the part of Ukraine, which is the East, which had voted for Yanukovych. You see, the country has always been divided between the East and the West, and it was the party of the regions in the East that gave its majority Yanukovych. So they see that this coup is putting out of power the person they elected. And then you put in the people from the other end of the country who then take the power so that they can run the election. And it's a sure thing that the one who's going to win is the one that the people in power from the West with the United States behind them is going to win. So the United States, it wasn't a matter of choosing democracy. It was a matter of choosing the west end of the country against the east end of the country, which was bound to cause a split, which is what happened. It's interesting because I'm just writing about Hillary Clinton, although it's just not her; it's everything. And I happen to go back and read Huntington. And Huntington predicted that Ukraine would split like this because it's right on the borderline of two civilizations. But he predicted that it would split peacefully because they just are two different because of the difference between them.
Well, it was also predictable, and that the Crimea would choose to go side with Russia.
Oh yes, he predicted that too.
And it's also interesting how when Khrushchev decided that maybe after too many schnapps or in 56 to make a paper change and give Ukraine a Crimea to Ukraine, it was considered a pass without notice in the United States because it was still the Soviet Union, and suddenly the Crimeans decide they want to stay with Russia and not go to this coup government in the West, in Kiev, suddenly Crimea becomes an integral part of Ukraine without any discussion of the long history of the connection of Crimea to Russia.
Well, not only that, you see, Ukraine hasn't been independent that long. It's been, 1991, 92? And right after it became independent of the Soviet Union, there was already a big movement in Crimea to ask to go back to Russia. This didn't just come up now. That's been there from the time that Ukraine went back, Ukraine became independent. The Crimeans have been talking about wanting to go back to Russia. And I think there was even a vote there in their parliament to go back to Russia. This is not new, but this just brought it back to the surface.
Well, we hear that there was like an invasion of Crimea by Russia, but Russian troops were already legally based in Crimea at the seaport there under the arrangement of the Ukrainian government. So there were already Russian troops there. The whole description of what has been going on, the shelling of the East has been done by the West, and we read headless stories that say the conflict has killed so many people. Conflicts don't kill people. People kill people. And the people...
Well, also, there's great talk about McCain and so on, about how we must give Kiev government defensive weapons. But you see, actually, they haven't been on the defensive. They've been on the offensive. Their war has been to reconquer the East and, in fact, drive people out. There's a huge... Remember when people were all upset about ethnic cleansing? Well, that's exactly what's been going on. Hundreds of thousands of people from eastern Ukraine have been fled, women and children especially, into Russia. And I don't think the nationalists and in the West, if you hear what they say sometimes over videos and so on, want them to come back. I think this is almost a deliberate ethnic cleansing to get the Russians out of Ukraine and destroy the industry, which was the industrial center of Ukraine. But it was industry that was selling its stuff to Russia. And the West is perfectly happy to destroy the industry, because then that's a way of destroying the trade with Russia, because they want to turn Ukraine totally toward the West. So there's nothing, no more relations with Russia. And that's what's really going on. And so it's a mixture of deliberately destroying the industrial end of the country and driving out the people, and we're going to sell defensive weapons to them. Actually, Ukraine has a whole lot of weapons. You know, it doesn't really need weapons. It needs money, and weapons cost money. And I suppose the money that Ukraine has gotten from the West will go for these weapons.
The United States had already put, according to Victoria Nuland, $5 billion into changing Ukraine and bringing it into the West, and had violated all the agreements that had been made in terms of moving NATO east toward the Soviet Union. We have one thing after another. We had the shooting down of the plane. I forget the name of the airline, but which was blamed on the Russian separatist. But there were
you
a lot
mean
of,
the Malaysian
Flight 17.
Flight 17.
That seemed to be to many a false flag incident, because that was used to escalate the anti-Russian propaganda.
Well, I don't know whether it's a false flag or not, because I don't have. The fact is that there's evidence on all sides, but I can't decide from that. But I think what is significant is the rapidity, the haste with which all on the West immediately, although they could not know, immediately blamed it on the separatists, on the Russians, and on Putin personally, who, by a funny coincidence, was flying over very close to the plane that was shot down at that time. He was coming back from a meeting in Brazil. And it's even conceivable, I mean, if you want to have conspiracy theories, that the Kiev people were trying to shoot down Putin's plane. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just saying that since you don't know and people are inventing explanations, that's one you could invent as well as the ones they did invent. The fact is that it's been kept secret. There's been great reluctance to make public when they found the black boxes. The whole thing looks very, very suspicious. But what is clear is that it was immediately exploited. Remember that the United States, during the Iraq-Iran war, shot down an Iranian airliner with even more civilians on it. And there was no cry to boycott the United States, because it shot down a regularly scheduled airliner in its exactly where it was supposed to be. And in fact, the United States decorated the sailors that did that.
That's correct. And Americans with very short memories and historically challenged, most don't even know about it or think it's of any consequence. After all, they're only Iranians. We've been brought up in this kind of xenophobic culture to believe America is the indispensable country and that Americans certainly have the right to lead the world. As the president said the other day, it's not if we lead, it's how we lead. And no other president of any other country speaks like this. I mean, obviously, we're indispensable in terms of starting wars in the Middle East and arming people on both sides to the teeth and then exploiting that for fun and profit. Diane, any last words before we end up here?
We didn't get around to the European reaction to this, which is, after all, I'm in Europe, and I could mention, one of the reasons I'm very, very worried and very, very pessimistic is that I think European leaders, political leaders, are dreading what's going on, but the media is following the United States. I don't know who pays them what, but for instance, Sarkozy the other day in front of his party, he defended the Russian position. I looked on television, not one television channel reported that. And when it was reported, it was, he takes the Kremlin line. The media is totally on the U.S. side. The Europeans don't want this war, but the public opinion, there's a lot of opposition in Germany. In France, it's not so vocal, but certainly among experts and so on. But the media is there. And they're telling the same kind of lies, not quite, not the version that nobody can believe that you see in the United States, which goes so far overboard. It's not credible, but it's very alarming. And I really feel that we're heading for absolute disaster. And something needs to be done. I mean, but what? There's no possible. You have to have a movement against war at the top of society, not just people who are doing identity politics and so on, but there has to be...
Diana, I this is really important. I have to end it there, unfortunately, but your warning is something we have to be talking about here. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today and bringing the information to us. Look forward to talking with you again, because this is such an important story. Thanks so much for being our guest.
Fine.
Take care. Bye-bye.